Hello and welcome to Talk From Superheroes. Hey everybody, I'm Andrew Rivamy.
And I'm Diana McCullum.
And you're listening to Talk From Superheroes, where every week we discuss a piece of superhero television or film. And this week on the podcast, we are doing our first ever James Bond on the podcast.
It seems impossible.
It does seem unlikely because they keep making these.
We've had a podcast for a while. He's an action franchise boy.
Daniel Craig's out there. He's shooting people and wearing suits.
And we like that.
And those are things we're typically a fan of fiction.
In fiction. Daniel Craig, don't go crazy.
Daniel. You can wear the suit though, Daniel.
You look great. You look wonderful. You're going to keep looking wonderful. Yeah, this is, oddly enough, our ramp up for the next Bond, which I think comes out in like a month and a half, but our schedule's real wonky.
Yeah. I think closer to a month, but the schedule is wonky. Everything's coming out at once, but everything is also just puzzle piece moving around. So I still don't have faith. No Time to Die is coming out on that actual date. I still don't have faith.
I was hardcore it's coming out on that date until they changed Venom 2 at the last second, but right. They moved it up. I'm like, everything is weird right now.
But then
now.
Dune also sneakily moved in the middle of the night as well.
Nothing seems to be going like years away anymore.
No, but there is definitely a lack of confidence and certainty with the release dates. Mm-hmm. I agree with you, they're not doing the big like, Dune and Venom will be February of next year, we're so sorry. But you just wake up one morning and it's been moved for some reason and we don't entirely know why or how.
With very little fanfare, my job is to keep track of when these movies come out, and I've missed a couple of the changes.
Yeah, they've been slipping. They've been slipping through the cracks. So we'll see. Presumably, No Time to Die will be out next month. So we're doing Casino Royale today. We're going to be joined by guest Craig Fay, host of the Villain Was Right podcast. In a little bit. But before we get into today's episode, we want to thank our friends over at Anthrodesk.
Anthrodesk, we love them. Their objective is to provide Canadians with sit-to-stand desks and modern ergonomic office accessories that contribute to a healthy and productive work life. And they have contributed to a healthy and productive work life for me. Mm-hmm. We both have Anthrodesk desks.
We do. They're nice and fancy.
We're an Anthrodesk family, or at least our office is an Anthrodesk office. Mm-hmm. We both love our sit-to-stand desks.
You push a little button, it's upstanding. It's so clean and convenient and nice because I know that there's a lot of different ways that like you can try to like sit or get comfortable, and like we've all had different office setups over the years where it's like, what if I read on a thing that if you hang upside down like a bat is a good way to work. Like there's always like a trend or a thing, but this is just, it's simple. I've got like four buttons on there. So I've got like sitting, I've got standing, we've got a little stationary bike that we can roll under there so you can get like a little bit of extra exercise. We've got a friend with one who's got a walking treadmill underneath there to get your steps in. It's just like, it's so customizable, and it's a quick button, and it's just a clean look as well.
They are sturdy. They're easy to put together. I put mine together by myself. Like, Andrew wasn't even home.
I actually think it might be the first piece of furniture you put together by yourself, since we've been together anyway.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. Because you're usually there to be like, no.
Oh, God, no.
And today I was like, yes, I can do this myself.
Where did you get a saw? They didn't even tell you to use a saw.
What I really like, though, is like they are sit to standing, but I honestly even just modify mine when I'm just sitting because I'm like, how did I have a desk that was only one height before? Like, I'm like sitting and I'm like, a little higher? A little lower. Like just like by increments, it's nice to be able to move it. And it's so sturdy. It's a gorgeous tabletop on mine. What do I have? I have the sit-to-stand height adjustable programmable standing desk with tabletop.
And it's gorgeous and it looks great. And like, yeah, there's different sizes. You can get L desk, corner desks, like whatever it is that you're looking for. You can get different types of setups, different weight gauges, different motors, depending on how much stuff that you have. So if you just want like a small, clean, simple, like you've got one monitor or just like a laptop, but you just want a little bit of extra function, you can get something for that. Or if you have a 9-monitor Twitch streamer Supreme L corner desk, you can also get something that's going to fit that need as well.
Yeah, they got standing desk converters, accessories, monitor mounts, anti-fatigue mats, and treadmills, everything you need for an incredible workspace experience. And they also stand 100% behind their products, offering the best warranty and a money-back guarantee and free shipping anywhere in Canada. Anthrodesk.
And we love them.
We love them.
They're terrific. So check it out at anthrodesk.ca. That's anthrodesk.ca. And thank you, Anthrodesk, for being our friends. And now let's get into the episode. Let's talk about Casino Royale. Right, so we have seen Casino Royale, and we are joined by our network's native James Bond expert, which is Craig May.
Hi, everybody. I am so excited to be here today. I have so many thoughts.
Fun fact, whenever you talk about James Bond, Craig Faye just appears.
Yeah. You got to mention it three times,
yeah,
though.
It's like Beetlejuice.
Yeah. I was going to say a candy man, but yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I think he's more fun.
Yeah, all right. Let's give him a Beetlejuice.
I'm going to give him a Beetlejuice vibe.
Yeah. On a scale of candy man to Beetlejuice, I'm giving Craig Faye a Beetlejuice about James Bond.
You're not wrong. I try and hold back sometimes.
You actually do a great job. I was even like, because I know you like certain Bond movies a lot, but I was like, is it even like Casino Royale? Like, I had to question.
Casino Royale is, it's not my favorite, but I think it's the best James Bond movie ever.
The best.
The best.
So yeah, let's start with the simple question of, usually it's did you like it, but you think it might be the best.
I think it is the best. So like, for so many reasons, but I'll juxtapose it with the movie that came right before it, which was Pierce Brosnan's Die Another Day. And if you have not seen that movie, it is fucking ridiculous. It is like over the top CGI, like crazy sci-fi plot. It is not a good movie.
Okay.
So Pierce Brosnan gets kicked out. There's all this commotion about whether or not Daniel Craig is going to be a good James Bond. People were like, they cast a blonde guy.
Ugh.
Like, he's going to be terrible.
Blondes can't act.
Yeah. And then they announced that they were rebooting the series because Casino Royale is the first novel that was ever written, but it's the last one that they ever got the rights to.
Okay.
So I just remember not being sure like what it was going to be and having an idea of what a James Bond movie is in my head and sitting in the theater and watching this, and just that opening pre-title sequence blew me away. Like they changed everything they had to. They stripped it down. They like focused on characters. It's actually compelling. It's, I think, one of the most physically brutal movies that James Bond has ever done. And it's just like, it blew me away the first time I saw it. I had no idea that a movie, let alone a James Bond movie, could be that good.
Okay.
Wow. Interesting. All right. So that's a high praise.
High praise.
That's a very high praise. All right. Moving around the table. Diana, did you like it?
I'm a little scared to say, like, I only liked it.
Yeah, fair enough.
Immediately pulls it back.
I'm a fan.
But like, it wasn't as good as I remembered. I do remember it being like one of the best things ever. But as I'm watching it, I'm like, oh, this is absolutely art. Like, it's everything about this is art, and like, it's artistically done. It's stylized beautifully. It's like really scripted in a beautiful, interesting way. But like half the time, I'm not really entertained, and I'm like, what are we trying to do? and I don't fully believe the Vesper thing, but like the action sequences are great. Daniel Craig's amazing. For like half the movie, I'm having a wonderful time. And it is always gorgeous to look at. So it's like a fairly high like, but I feel like I remembered it being a love.
Fair enough.
Mm-hmm. Andrew, yourself?
A very high like and almost a love. I feel like I'm kind of in between both of you here because I am not the Bond aficionado that Craig is, but I had seen pretty much all of the Bonds. You know, I saw all the Brosnan ones in theaters. I was a big fan of the series. You know, I think I might have seen all of the Bonds several times, maybe Lazenby's only once. But it's, I'm familiar with the franchise, and I feel like this movie popped harder in theaters to juxtapose Brosnan. So I agree with Craig on that, where it's like the weekend I saw this in theaters, Diane, I remember that feeling you're describing of like, I remember, and rewatching it this week, it's like, I remember this being way more impactful than it was. And I think it's because in When you like step back and look at the lineup of James Bond movies, when you pluck this out, it's not quite as remarkable as when you watch it in juxtaposition of what's come prior, and it hits harder as just this statement piece to be like, this is what we are now, this is what this franchise is, we are redefining, and it punches harder. But going back to it, it's impossible to recreate that punch. That's just something that is literally impossible to do in the scheme of storytelling, which is to go back and recapture and rebottle a feeling that changed the game in a moment.
And I also, like, just to add to that, you're right, is because other Daniel Craig James Bond movies have come out since. So yeah, that's kind of now, like, what you expect. But this was, like, out of left field as far as what to expect. And this movie did a lot of things that movies did for the first, or, like, spy movies and action movies did for the first time. Like, it was quite innovative with how it worked. So, like, yeah, it's hard to rewind the clock and forget that this contributed to the path that we're on right now.
And I'll give it a little, you know, it gets bonus points because it contributed to that path, even though I might not feel it on rewatch. But on rewatch, I still feel a lot. It's still very well made. Like, the set pieces are incredible. It's well done. That's why it's still a high like on rewatch. Everything is successfully executed and is a lot of fun with some great action scenes. But it doesn't have that special X factor that it had only at that little window of time when it existed. So that's kind of where I'm at. High like was a love when I first saw it in theaters.
I love that analysis. I love that you can step back and really look at the big picture in that way, because I think that does make sense, because I also remember this being a love, but I think I like Skyfall a lot more. So, like, now even within Craig's own franchise, I've, like, found a better one for me. But yeah, this was, I get what you're saying, like, what a shift from Brosnan.
Yeah,
like, he was just a silly boy by the end on a green screen.
I walked out of Casino Royale in the theater, and I was a huge Brosnan fan. I really liked him. I was very disappointed when he didn't get his fifth movie, and I walked out of Casino Royale and I go, Daniel Craig makes Pierce Brosnan look like a cardboard cutout. Like, in terms of being able to take and throw a punch, I was like, Pierce Brosnan is a cardboard cutout of a man.
Yeah.
Yeah, I will say Daniel Craig definitely feels like he is actually fighting all these people, and that Daniel Craig himself could defeat them.
Yes, and that's, like, like, right off the get-go, I mentioned that pre-title sequence, which
the
I think
black is
the black and white sequence.
That's
Let's
a
get
wild
into this.
Choice.
Yeah, that's a wild choice. And again, like, you're like a James Bond movie in black and white. Like contrast that to, like, Roger Moore walking out in, like, a fucking tuxedo and jumping over alligators, right? You're like, what's going on right now? And it's like this, he's become a 00 agent. So immediately you're like, this is a reboot. This is his first mission. That framing device of, they would have sent a 00 agent if they knew I was corrupt, and you don't have any kills on your record. It requires two. And then cutting to that bathroom brawl scene, which was, again, I can't say enough, shocking in its brutality.
Yeah.
Like, he's putting a guy's head through a wall. He's smashing him into a porcelain thing. James Bond is drowning a man in a sink.
Such a brutal way to kill someone.
So brutal. And, like, their feet are slipping, and, like, nobody's in control of that situation.
It's inelegant. It's grimy. It feels like James did not at all prepare for that kill that day. Like,
exactly.
It almost feels like M just, like, locked the two of them in the room and was like, one of you's getting upgraded. And it's that type of just, like, a murder death match.
Yeah, so like, all of a sudden they've stripped all the refinement out of a character that's, like, walks into a room, is, like, you know, adjusts his tie and punches a guy out. And you see this man, like, physically struggling in this brutal, brutal takedown. And you immediately go, well, this is different. He's going to fail at things. Mm. He's going to hurt himself. Like, I think James Bond could hurt himself or die in this movie, which is such a hard thing to make me feel, because he's James Bond. Of course he's going to get out of it okay. And then that juxtaposition between him brutally murdering a man in a bathroom to this cold, calculated, I just shoot you from across the room.
It's such an amazing, like, dialogue, right, as well. Like, when he shoots him, like, before he's even done his sentence, like, the second one is easier. I'm like, ooh, you became elegant so fast. Yeah. Like, you give a man a minute to get himself together after a bathroom kill, and he can really...
Yeah.
He can really get some shit done. He can
really do it. Yeah.
Yeah. And, like, you see that he's working on it, but even throughout the rest of the movie, he doesn't get things right. He's not that suave and sophisticated. That's kind of the arc of Daniel Craig's movies, is, like, him slowly becoming more sophisticated. Just to jump ahead a couple places, like, another place where you see that, like, that naivete or that inexperience or... the not being smart enough to like kind of get ahead is the parkour scene,
right?
Where you literally see him. A traditional version of that scene is him gingerly hopping from beam to beam and chasing the guy. But what you see in this is he takes a running jump off something and bangs his head off of pipes.
Yeah,
and keeps going. You see him running through drywall.
Yeah.
Just to get to a guy. He and it's inelegant.
Right,
and he's hurting himself, and you go. Oh, you hear him clang off the pipes and you go, ooh.
Well, what I take, oh no, you go ahead.
Oh, I love this scene because the parkour scene's amazing. But like another inelegant thing that I think other Bonds would do in it is I love the fact that you could just wait for this guy to come down during the parkour scene. Like, I feel like other James Bonds would be like, what are you going to do when you get to the top of the crane, buddy? There's no helicopter waiting to take you away. Like, I feel like Brosnan and other Bonds would have just been like, I'm just going to wait down here. You got to come back down. But this guy is just like, no, I got to go where he goes.
I do agree.
A little less experience.
There easily could be like an Indiana Jones gun and a whip version of that fight sequence where it's like I'm more clever, and I think there are moments during that fight sequence where like when he unclips the weight from the crane and uses it like an elevator as opposed to climbing up a rope hand over hand, so there are little windows, little glimmers of this guy actually is clever and does deserve his job and 00 status, but there are moments where he's also an idiot. I think just to go back to the black and white opening for a second as well, I think what one of the purposes of this opening sequence, and obviously it's just like it's stylized, it's a brutal fight sequence to show the brutality of a kill, juxtaposing it with like him being classy immediately afterwards and guessing these words, and it's a cool set piece, but I almost feel like it is a window into what the birth of all the 00 agents have been. Like, I think the black and white alone is meant to be just kind of a throwback, even though you can do anything in black and white, obviously, but it's meant to be this like classic cinema look. It feels black and white. It feels old. It feels old James Bond. And it is the movie in the franchise saying to me like, you realize how broken these men have always been, and we just never showed it to you.
Yes.
It's not them saying that this is the one that's broken. It is them, I think by it being in black and white, it's them saying they've always been broken. We just never let you see when they break. And when he becomes classy after that first kill, it's not that he becomes classy. And I think it's this implication that James Bonds have never been classy. Maybe they have to a certain degree. You know, they probably know more. They probably know more about caviar than I do. But they're never classy. They're not hopping over alligators holding a martini because they're like, I just grew up hopping over alligators holding a martini. I'm very rich and always have been.
Yeah.
They act like that because they're detached from reality, because that first kill broke threads in their brain. Yeah. And I think that that's what this opening is showing, is just being like, this isn't a new James Bond. This is the same as all the others, but we're going to show you when that first kill ripped his grasp on reality apart, and when he's calm, cool, and collected later, it's that's not because disturbing. He's like lived a lifetime and has become calm, cool, and collected. He's fucked. He does not know what death and reality is anymore, and no longer cares.
Yeah, and I think that's I'm so glad you brought that up, because that's an aspect that gets lost about James Bond, which I love, and this movie handles very well. Mm. You are not a good person.
Mm.
He is not a person to envy. And I think there's so many points in this movie where they call him out for that. Where, you know, M is saying, it was too soon to promote you. You're a blunt instrument. You don't understand how this works. You violate the one rule of international law, you know, that is inviolatable, you know, blowing up an embassy sort of thing. Vesper, when they meet, she nails him immediately and runs down all of those things that you said. This is jumping a bit ahead in the movie, but like just where she goes – okay, I'm going to do you now. Like, they're kind of going back and forth. And she goes, you went to Oxford or some other school. And so naturally you think human beings dress like this. Like, he's in his tux or whatever.
You wear it with resentment.
But you wear it with such disdain.
Disdain is
such a good... And it's just like, so you were there by someone else's graces and they never let you forget it. MI6 looks for maladjusted young men like you who don't question whatever. Mm-hmm. And you just go, oh, that's him. That's him. Yeah. That's him at the beginning. And another great thing is about this movie... James Bond is a different character at the end of this movie than he is at the beginning. This is, I think, the only James Bond movie I've seen where there is a very noticeable and marked character change, which is what you want. You want a character to change.
I agree with that. I want to unpack more of that later, for sure, but I do agree with that.
I do also, because I like the thing about the tuxedo a lot, because I think it goes to, or the line about the disdain of the tuxedo, because I think it goes to what Andrew says, and that the James Bonds... they're not fancy men who learned how to kill. They're killers who learned to become fancy men.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, they're not, like, already, like, we were, like, Kingsman-like types who, like, decided to kill. They're like, no, we are brutal killing machines. And then they gave us tuxedos and said, you're spies now. Like, it's the other way around. Like, they want you to think they've, like, we eat caviar on our own. Like, he absolutely does not. He eats protein powder and he has to work out. Like, he is not this when he's not spying.
That's a great breakdown. I love how you can distill something that takes me 10 minutes to get out. And you're like, oh, you mean they're killers who learn to be fancy and not fancy people who learn to be killers? I'm like, fuck, that is exactly it. That is exactly the distillation.
I wouldn't have got there without your thing.
I wouldn't have been able to distill it without your thing. I appreciate you so much. That is perfect. I do want to talk about the beginning of this parkour scene. There's a couple of dated things about this movie that I find very funny.
Okay.
One is the fact, and I think that this might have even been dated at the time, not even just today in retrospect, but the earpiece thing. So the beginning of the parkour chase scene, the like, remove your hand from your bloody ear, and he's like, the one bad spy has got his finger on his ear to showcase that he is a spy on camera who is saying things into an earpiece. But nowadays, we've got like AirPods and wireless headphones. Like, seeing someone have a thing in their ear and talk is not that uncommon. And even then, if it was just wired, it wouldn't be that big of a deal. Like, it's one of these things where, like, by trying to hide it more, you've made it more obvious you're a spy.
Yeah.
By making it a skin, flesh-toned inner ear canal earpiece. Whereas if you just had wired white headphones and were on a phone call with James, no one would be curious about you in any way.
I never thought about that.
And
you're right.
I feel like since the advent of headsets, like, spy movies have not known how to confront that. They're still just like, and the spy has a phone in his cufflinks. Oh no, the villain saw him talking into his cufflinks. Why wasn't he just using his fucking phone? People have headphones.
That would be the most deterrent thing I can possibly imagine. Like, well, that's not the spy. He's just openly on his phone.
Yeah.
That guy's having an argument with his wife on his phone, so it's not him, and it's definitely him. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. I don't think you would be having a phone call at, like, a cockfight. Is that the setting
the
for
snake,
it?
No, I think it is.
Snake and a mongoose.
If I was on the phone and just every now and then be like, James, I have eyes on him, but every couple of words I'd be like, oh, shit, snake and mongoose! Or like me yelling into the phone to be like, all right, I'm here. You want me to put money on snake or mongoose? Just yelling shit into the phone.
Snake's doing pretty good.
I like the look of this snake.
He's a good looking snake. I think he shed recently. He's going to be slippery. Oh, he's running. He's running. The snake is running? Talking about not the snake, James.
Yeah, and they use that twice in this movie of getting discovered via earpiece, because James gets pinpointed in the hallway as well. Yeah, I think like the spy's greatest asset right now would be just creating
AirPods.
It's just AirPods. And I realize you can't be on a phone call all the time, but just create your short range radio, but make it look like an AirPod. Just put that in an AirPod now, and you'd be like, oh, a dude in a hotel with an AirPod with a wireless headphone in his ear.
Also, 2006, there's a big chance that guy attacked a dude making out with a girl, and he just happened to have
a hearing aid.
Yeah, does look like a hearing aid. I'll give you that. I really hope No Time to Die just has AirPods now, hon. I hope you've called it. I'm really excited.
They won't, because these movies are produced by Sony. Yes, in case you didn't notice from all the longing shots of the Sony Ericsson and Sony Vaio.
James Bond
used Sony products, everybody.
Yeah, and Sony makes also wireless headphones. They do. Well, they make wireless earbuds that are actually quite good.
Not as iconic as the iconic. AirPods
no,
look.
No. Mm-hmm.
Fair enough.
But none of Sony's shit is. But yeah, that was just...
Do you want a 2006 Sony Ericsson? Look at all the wonderful features it has as James Bond flips through it for 30 seconds of a 2.5 hour movie.
God, it's the Sony products are so embarrassing. Because Sony does make good products in the world. Like their headphones are one of them. They make great headphones. But it's never their good products that they have in Bond movies. It's always products I've never seen anywhere. I've never seen a human own one, or I've never even seen it for sale in a store. Like every James Bond movie through the Daniel Craig and Brosnan era, where it's like, check out this hot Sony Ericsson. I'm like, I've never seen that in a store, let alone a human have it. I couldn't get that today if I wanted to, because you don't manufacture these. No one cares. I've never known anyone who's had a Sony laptop.
Yeah, I was thinking that even as I watched this movie, because they keep showing the Sony Ericsson, and it's this like white kind of brick of a phone, and I'm like, I've never seen that phone. Like, I was looking at phones in 2006. I've never seen this weird bricky thing.
I worked at a cell phone store for 10 years, and I've never sold a Sony phone.
Did anyone ever walk in and they're like, James Bond phone, please, and you had to be like, don't got it.
They're like, I'm sorry.
People were still, in 2006, people still wanted the flip Matrix phones. They're like, do you have the ones that pop out? Because at least those were fucking cool.
Yeah,
you know
that's
what I mean?
True. Yeah, yeah. That the slide out. That was actually kind of cool and slick. Yeah, Motorola had it locked down
For a brief minute.
Yeah, Motorola was doing good things. Yeah, bad product placement in the James Bond movies other than Aston Martin and cars. And even then, when this movie starts with, or not starts, but like once he gets to, is it Morocco?
You're talking about the car?
When he shows up in
Jamaica.
And he's in a Ford Focus. He's in like a rental vehicle from the airport, but they still give it the glamorous car shots.
By the way.
And I think that's kind of funny.
I fucking love that. People were so upset. I remember like online forums, they were so upset. They're like, oh, James Bond wouldn't drive a Ford. It was a Fiesta. Mm. And I was just like, no, but he's not James Bond yet. Like... Like the idea of him driving this little compact car, and it's the it's just, oh, that's so funny. That's so funny. And then, of course, he goes and wins.
It also made perfect sense because he was off mission. M didn't authorize this. So he just had to get whatever they had at the airport. Like, they don't have an Aston Martin sitting at the airport car rental office. I'm sorry. But yeah, it's so funny that as soon as he gets there, he's like, I'm going to win this car real quick because I can't drive this Ford Fiesta.
The traditional DB9.
This is not even part of the plot that I have just won this car.
It showed
he was good at cards.
I guess it did establish that. Yeah. But it is also just a, like, here's a fun car now for him to have.
And the car is the DB9. It's the one that he's always had. Mm-hmm. Like, that's, like, Goldfinger. It's like he's got it, and now it's in a lot of the James Bond movies. It's in Goldeneye, actually. That's the car he's driving in the street race.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
To rewind a little bit, I think I do just want to dive in one more time to that opening parkour sequence.
Yeah.
Because this is another reason why I think that, obviously a great sequence, but it doesn't pop as much on rewatch, because when this came out, I feel like for a lot of people, this was the first time they saw a parkour sequence
100%.
In film, where it was like, maybe if you were like hardcore into action movies, like at the time it was like, I knew this was choreographed by one of the guys from District B13, who was like the parkour movie from France and like part of that movement. So it's like, I'd seen some, but I'm going to say like 90% of audiences were like, what the fuck is this?
Because 2006, YouTube wasn't a big thing.
Yes.
So it's not like
or
you were
getting, yeah.
Yeah. So it's not, or like, you know, just getting started. So it's not like everyone was on YouTube and they like, you'd watch these parkour things. And like to see it done, first of all, to see those stunts done for real, which they were, right? Like the guy, I don't have his name written down, but like he's one of the inventors of parkour. The guy that he's chasing.
A special credit in the opening credits. Like I've never seen that special parkour stunts by or something.
Oh, it's in the opening.
He's in the top opening credits where parkour stunts by.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So he was really doing all those things compared to again, contrast it with the movie that came before where it's it was all CGI. It was all people on wires and stunts like that. And there's something about it being real where you feel like these are real stakes and that there's real trouble.
Yeah.
And it's so impressive.
Yeah. It's so cool for so many reasons. First time we've seen parkour. The great juxtaposition of I'm the fast guy and James Bond is just literally a blunt instrument. As M said, he's I'm going to walk through a wall because I can't parkour is so funny, but also
because drywall's not that tough.
So much of his character though. Yeah. The other guy could have just
drywall. Anyone could just make it through drywall.
The weird thing though is being the first parkour scene is I remembered there being a lot more traditional parkour, but the parkour stunts will only be 2 seconds, in one shot. And I was I remember a lot of long free running shots or something. But the first time you're going to have a parkour scene is not going to be the best one ever. But it's still really, really good and tells so much of the story through the action, which is so hard.
Yeah. You get an idea. Yeah. As you said, you get an idea of who James Bond is by how he's reacting to these things. When the guy tries to shoot him and he it's out of bullets, so he throws the gun, and James Bond catches it and throws it back at him.
Whips it back.
I was like, that's a move.
Guns are heavy.
Yeah, a mind-blowing action scene to start the movie. It wowed people in the theater when we saw it.
Yeah, I remember it was one of those things that everyone was talking about it afterwards to be like, this is something called parkour?
I did just check because I was curious. This movie was 2006. The Office didn't do their parkour episode till 2009. So that's when the world kind of parkour.
It took this and 3 years of people doing YouTube searches for videos that weren't super prevalent and were very grainy and low quality for the world to be like, oh shit, parkour is a thing. Yeah. So a very impressive, groundbreaking chase scene, especially from a franchise where it's all car chases and gunshots to be we started with a brutal fist fight and now we're doing a very particular and stylized foot chase. It also really establishes the foundation of Daniel Craig's series in something that is different and gritty and kind of real as well.
Yeah, real isn't a great word to use because despite it being a little over the top, this movie was very much based in reality. You're I could see a person doing that.
Yeah, and none of it felt unrealistic.
Yeah, And to that point, they stripped away a lot of the traditional James Bond things. There is no... you've got M in this movie, Judi Dench, fantastic. But there's no Q, right?
No Q.
In every James Bond movie up until this, except for Dr. No.
Diana has hard opinions about the no Q.
Well, okay, but...
I get it, but I'm like... You still had, six guys at MI6 helping you. Why wasn't one of them Q?
Well, yeah, but because then you get to introduce Q later, and it's awesome. There's no... But in every James Bond movie, there was a Q scene. It was just a requirement. Whether or not you needed to have Q in the movie or not, Q needed to show up. There was always a Moneypenny scene. And Moneypenny, in so many ways, is not essential to the plot, but you've got to come and have James Bond come into the office and flirt with the secretary for a bit. And, there was the gadgets. Gadgets were always huge. There's not really gadgets in this movie. There's a defibrillator and but those are all things that exist.
Yeah.
And they got rid of all of this stuff. And they were what is going to make a good James Bond movie that's driven by story and not just this check mark of these are the elements that we need to hit.
Right. And they still hit the check marks of a traditional James Bond franchise as well, to a certain degree.
But they chose which ones they picked.
Yeah. So once we...
Oh, I was just going to say they had such confidence in the reboot that they're we'll add those as we go. We're not going to front load the first movie with them. We'll add Moneypenny. We'll add Q. We'll add gadgets. I don't even know if they've ever added gadgets, actually. Daniel Craig is not a gadget man.
Well, I think they realize that that's kind of one of the more ridiculous parts. There have definitely been gadgets... but God, I know it's from a later movie where he hands him a pen and he goes, Q, he's like, what is this, a grenade? He goes, no, it's a pen. Sign for your gun. And it's like a gun and a radio transmitter. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, I love that so much. Like
the gun at least is like DNA coded and only Bond can shoot it. So yeah, it's like, fingerprint it's like gun, a but gadget, that's... but it's not like silly.
And I think that is the gadget thing is a tougher thing for a James Bond series to do today than it was ages ago. Because today it's just our technology has advanced so far that in terms of what is like publicly available, or at least publicly available to like in short production to rich people, that to get something that is so to like create something for a movie that is above what the public is aware of
yeah.
would have to bridge so far into science fiction that it defies the bounds of reality. Where it's like we have there are robot AI like actual like robots with artificial intelligence walking around in the world right now. So you would have to give James Bond a telepathy machine to create anything even one step yeah. above what has actually been created in the world. And to even go that one step above turns James Bond into a full science fiction fantasy.
It's so true. And the other problem with gadgets is they spoil a lot of the movie if you're paying attention because they're so specific. And they're like, this is an ultrasonic shark repellent.
You know, I wonder if they'll be sharks.
Yeah, exactly. Or this has this is a belt with a grappling line in it. It's got enough weight to hold one person. And you're like, well, you mentioned it has enough weight to hold one person. I wonder if you're going to try and make it hold two later.
Yeah.
You know, like you just go, this is going to show up to solve such a specific problem later on that I'm not even excited to see this problem. I'd much rather see him fist fight his way out of a room, you know? Like it's...
But this movie is so clever because even like, as you said, the gadget is probably like the defibrillator built into the car. But when they show it, they don't even tell you that's a defibrillator. Like it opens up, his like glove compartment opens up and you see something and then it closes and then you get a gun. You're like, well, what was that first thing? He's like, we're not even going to tell you.
Yeah.
We're going to establish it's there so yeah. it's not a cheat later, but we're not going to tell you that's a defibrillator. I'm like, oh, shit, that's a new way to do a gadget.
And I like that, too, because also it doesn't even draw too much attention to it because maybe you see it and you think, like, what's that? Will I see it later? But also it's just the possibility of, like, there's some other shit in your glove box. Like, I don't care.
Shit in your glove box.
I don't care how cool or what kind of a world-class super spy you are. There's other shit in your glove box. There is at least like there is at least registration papers in case you get pulled over. There's a manual no one's ever looked at yep. for your fucking car. There's other shit in there.
There's a pack of gum in there.
There's always a pack of gum in there. It's
always a pack of gum.
I almost want to see
Kleenex.
Like, I want to see James Bond open it. There's a gun, the automatic electronic defibrillator. And just like a paper bag filled with loose ketchup packets left over from takeout.
Some
like,
chopsticks. You know, yeah, and like
there's the wooden chopsticks in there. The shit we all have in our glove box.
Pre-packed by Q. This isn't even James's. This yeah. is like Q put those in there. It's like he's going to need some napkins.
Forget gritty street fighting. That's how you ground this James yeah. Bond, all right? Give me a James Bond with a ketchup packet in his glove box.
And some fucking loose change in the ashtray.
Fuck yeah. That's what I'm all about.
That's our James Bond. Since we're mildly on the car, I did also want to say, you were like, he's gun chases and he's like fist fights. But this movie also has, I think the car chase at the airport's incredible.
It's
I think that
great.
Was actually my favorite action scene.
It's very well
it's
done.
It's very well, like watching him chase him through security onto the truck.
Figuring out what ellipsis actually means.
Ellipsis
like in that moment, like it's like code.
Hanging the bomb off the guy, like it all really
and that
works.
Smirk. They don't show the guy blow up. They just show James Bond smirk like a psychopath.
I fucking
and you're
blew
like,
that guy to shit. And like, that's such a good way to kill someone because you're like, you blew yourself up.
Yeah.
Congratulations, you played yourself.
If you hadn't hit that button, you'd be alive.
Yeah. And I just at the end of that sequence, such a good sequence. There's this brilliant moment of acting by Daniel Craig where the brakes aren't working on this fuel truck that's going to careen into this airplane, and he just yanks the steering wheel hard and like skids it to a stop. And then there's just this moment where he just like looks up at the airplane and like looks down to where he stopped, and it's like, oh, he's amazed that he pulled that off.
Right.
It's like it's this brief moment of like, that was a close one. And it's this perfect subtle cap on like what an amazing action scene it was.
And then like you mentioned, psychopath, because it is clever the way he does like the clip-on thing. And you're right, the guy does kill himself. but that man turned to mist. Like James Bond smiled, and I get if he smiled before, a smile before would be like, I'm clever, I got you. And I feel like that's what you're like, your John McClane's and other like American action heroes do, which is the smile before, I got you, then you kill yourself. He smiles after he unblinkingly watched a man eviscerate himself. And that is haunting. That is a, like, you no longer understand, like, mortality. Like, you watched a man turn inside out just now.
Yeah, that actually, that's a great point. I didn't think of it that way. Because watching a man turn into bloody mist is very different than just the idea of being like, gotcha.
Yeah.
Watching a man stop being a man and then just still smiling is...
This is at least the second man that he's killed that day.
That day.
Yeah.
Because he stabbed a man to death earlier in the
day. Like an hour ago to get to the airport at the incredibly busy Body Works display.
Oh, yeah, the Body Works Museum.
Open 24/7. They have it out front, so it's legit.
This is wild to me. As someone who has seen the Body Works display, and it's very good, but you're not allowed to touch the bodies, and these ones are all really close, and they're not allowed this many people inside.
I don't think everyone's like drinking and having a fucking party. Like, it is a party there.
Yeah. I mean, actually, maybe that's like a little bit of a precursor of what we're going to see a body turn inside out later when we blow this guy up.
Fair enough.
It was a hint.
It's foreshadowing.
That's why James was so desensitized to seeing the human skeleton.
I've been to Body World. I know what it looks like inside.
But yeah, that's a great, great chase scene across the tarmac. Absolutely, like it just works. Watching it this time, it reminded me a little bit of Raiders of the Lost Ark, that chase scene where he's in the car and then he's outside of it and he's on top of it and then he's trying to get back in. Like I was like, that just works really well.
I was gonna say it's a little bit reminds me of that because a man turns to mist at an airport.
Yeah.
The Indiana Jones scene where the man's pushed into the blades of an airplane.
I forgot about that.
Yeah, I thought that's what you were going to say.
Well, never mind. This whole thing's been stolen from Indiana Jones. It's been stolen.
We've already seen the car chase man turn to mist at an airport.
I don't need to see two mist men.
Should we talk a little bit about the villain? Should we talk a bit about Mads Mikkelsen as Lachief? How do we feel about Mads?
I love Mads, but I actually don't know how I feel about this villain. Because he's not all that villainous. He really is the money man.
Which is like a villain and fuck these people in real life. But it's not an active, engaged villain. It is unlike other villains who are like, Mr. Bond, I will kill you and flood California.
Yeah,
he's a dude who is just a like... I am evil due to the capitalist structures of society and the way that very complicated international finance works, which is villainy, but it's boring villainy to watch and it's not engaged with our hero.
Yeah, as we said, this movie is very grounded. So the fact that he is a villain because he invests cash, evil money into the stock market, I'm like, so real.
It is.
But also like not the kind of villainy that I'm used to. Like too real?
Well, the thing I really like about him is there's a reason that MI6 would be after him.
Yes, absolutely.
Right? Like
he knows where all the money from.
He knows where all the money is. He's a high profile target. And weirdly enough, so the book, the original novel, the entire novel happens at the casino. So nothing that happens before James Bond arrives at the casino is in the book.
Oh.
And it's not poker, it's like Baccarat.
It's Baccarat, which is a great choice to make. Like to go back to poker.
Oh yeah. I thought you were gonna say Baccarat is a great choice to make. I'm like, that's the most boring, complicated game imaginable.
And it's also
Sorry, Baccarat fans, if we have any listeners who are over 70 somehow.
But Lachief is also a Soviet agent who's bankrolling Soviet agents in France or whatever. So it's like, I really like that it makes sense that they go after him and that he is a vulnerable target and you understand why he's vulnerable. But you're right. He doesn't actually do much.
No.
And I think if it was anybody but Mads playing this,
it'd be
kind of boring
because
he's so sinister.
Mads is fantastic. No problem with Mads. And also like the little touches, like... Again, I like that this movie sets things up that kind of aren't really relevant. They're just like touches. Like he's using an inhaler and his eye is bleeding. And those never come into play. Like, that's not how Bond beats him. The inhaler thing, I was like, oh, he's going to gas somebody and just gave himself an antidote. But that's not what happened, because that's usually what an inhaler is. It's right. Like, I just antidoted myself. I'm going to gas everybody here. But he is just a man who needs
an inhaler and has and a fucked up eye.
That's a reversal of tropes right there in itself, that the inhaler was nothing. Mm. Like, they are cool ideas here for this villain.
Yeah, and just his statement, it's nothing sinister. It's just a derangement of the tear duct. But I do love that probably in an earlier version of this, that his tell... in the poker game is that he bleeds from the eyes and just be like, that's his tell. Like, they had to make it so obvious that every moving going person like would be like, I see that now. And I think at some point they were like,
just touch your eye. Yeah,
professional poker players would all pick up that you bleed from your eye every time you bluff.
Multi-million-dollar poker players would notice that. Yeah, I do think Mads might be one of the only people who could play this role. You're right. Maybe Christopher Waltz might be able to sneak in there.
Who they wasted Inspector. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. Yeah. Exactly. But but Mads does a good job of it. I weirdly thought what they were going to do with this, and I think it's from a previous James Bond movie. When I first saw this movie, I was like, oh, his eye's bleeding because he's X-raying the cards. You might know this. This happened in a James Bond movie.
Almost certainly, where
one villain was winning a card game because he was X-raying the cards, which showed him what cards people had, which is not how X-rays work. You would just see an outline of a sheet of paper. Like, the colored ink wouldn't show up on an X-ray for you to, like, read the... But anyway, I thought that that's what... they were going to do with that.
No,
why he was bleeding from the eye, because you shouldn't put an X-ray machine in your eye socket. I'm not a doctor. I don't know if that would cause you to bleed from your eye.
I mean, the X-rays are going out.
Don't put it in there.
I get what you're saying. Now, I will say, obviously, we're talking about how he's not all that villainous, but we would be remiss if we don't talk about the torture scene.
The torture scene is, again... you know,
something
brutal.
We've never seen in a Bond movie.
Brutal is the big, like, you know, in lights theme of this movie. And that scene, I can tell you, there was every guy in the movie theater when we saw this was like,
this is my favorite torture scene of all time.
Oh,
I will absolutely, because I think because it is all testicular torture, it's the only torture scene I can watch and be like, doo doo doo, doo doo doo, and feel nothing, but also be like very entertained, and it's like relevant to the plot.
Yeah. And I just love the line of, I do not understand all these elaborate torture techniques. It is the simplest thing in the world to cause a man too much pain that he can bear. And he's just like hanging his jacket and rolling up his sleeves. Because in previous James Bond movies, you have people like, he's an expert in torture and he like tortures people for 9 hours. And then it's just a guy with a fucking rope and a chair just whacking him in the balls. And I think, and you, your audience can correct me if I'm wrong with this, but I believe I saw an interview between Daniel Craig and Mads Mikkelsen where they were talking about how they had to sort of edit this scene down to get the PG-13 rating.
That makes sense.
Like, they were like, can we do this? Can we do this? And they, like, went a little further and then, like, cut it down. And it's like, but it's fucking brutal.
It is brutal. It's a powerful scene. It hits really hard. I don't know what to take away from this scene, because what I felt like this scene meant in the context of the film, because so much throughout the film has been kind of subversion of James Bond tropes. And James Bond always the guy who hooks up with ladies and the hot women at the end. And Mads being like, you will be unrecognizable down there. Like Mads being like, I'm going to destroy you. I thought this was also like another destruction of a James Bond trope, to be like, he's now not going to be the guy who floats off on a boat and fucks the woman at the end. And then they still do that. So it does make it strange to be like, I thought that this was the villain taking away something that is an identifier of James, but the movie gives it back to him. And I don't know if I need the movie to end with James like looking in a mirror and being like, your balls are destroyed, James, never fuck again. But I do feel like they kind of like really are like, ooh, and then he has an ouchie for a bit. But don't worry about it. He's fine. He's fine. He's back. He's fine. He's fucking. He's fine. Don't think about it too much. Oh, we wanted you to be grossed out for a minute. But now look at us. We're tap dancing. Tap dance away.
He's still James Bond. Don't you worry.
Dick works fine.
He can still fuck. And we're going to acknowledge that as canon in a little while.
He can still fuck in a hospital setting. The doctors are right outside that door.
He hasn't been cleared to leave the hospital.
Yeah. In contrast to what you're saying, I will say it is an interesting torture because, one, he does stand to lose something that he actually values, which is his masculinity and his toxic masculinity at that.
Not my toxic masculinity.
And at that point, we know... Please.
No, that's my one weakness.
My masculinity. It's so toxic. I've worked so hard on it. And the other aspect is he doesn't solve this problem. He was fucked if this had gone on and Mr. White didn't show up to kill him.
Yeah.
The mysterious Mr. White. So it's like, one, it shows that he's not really in control. There's other forces at play. And the other thing that he stands to lose here is Vesper, who... I do believe at this point in the movie, I care very much about the two of them.
Mm. Yeah,
yeah. I will agree with Craig that I took that as the takeaway because he doesn't get himself out of this one. Mm. Whereas I feel like every other like kind of death trap, he's like, I threw the coin and I made the laser not hit me or whatever he does. Like I used the gadget. He didn't have any gadgets. He was literally stripped bare.
Naked.
Like they took everything off of his body. Like they almost like they knew he was full of gadgets. Like, they were like, strip this man down, no gadgets.
They've been like, we've seen James Bond movies.
We've seen the movies, we know the tropes. I also really love the subtle detail of he does this so often, his henchmen just automatically knew to go cut a hole in a chair. He's like, we know what he's gonna do. He's gonna fucking hit him in the balls over and over again.
Just a henchman spraying down the ball chair with a pressure hose, being like, we got to get this ready for the next one. We got to change over the room. He's coming in with a fresh one all the time. Get the ball chair ready.
But yeah, I also agree with Andrew that it's like they take something away from him, but then they're like, no, we didn't.
Yeah, you can't give it back right away. Like, I'm not saying you can never give it back, but you can't give it back within a 10-minute window of the film. Like, that is way too soon. To kind of strip and then take and then give back. Yeah. Yeah. I would say the other thing that stands out to me during this movie, and 2006 wasn't long enough ago for this to work, is the money is too little. Does anybody else feel that watching it?
How much was it?
$15 million was the big.
It was $150 million.
Was it 100? I thought it was 15.
No, because they all put 10 in.
Yeah, it was.
Oh, the total pot was 150.
Yeah.
But when it comes to the Treasury Department bankrolling James, they're like, it's a $10 million buy-in, and then if you've been good, we can approve another $5 million. And when James goes for it, like obviously, like Vesper is like there's other things at play, but it's this like, fuck, I don't know if we can give James $5 million. I'm like, you spent more than that on an air show, and this is the key to all of the terrorists in the world ever. This is nothing. $5 million is nothing. Like, $5 million is some road repairs. Like, $5 million is, in terms of like extrajudicial black ops government agent operations, $5 million was way too little to be a sticking plot point in this movie. And it was all I could think about. That I'm like, at this point, I'm like, Drake could bankroll you. You have the monarchy. And Drake could bankroll you taking down all of the terrorists in the world. This is too little money. The 150 total being the thing that Lashif needs, that does work. That's an amount that does hit that. I owe people a lot of money. I got to get this back in the stock market. But the $5 million, I'm like, celebrities could make this happen.
He's new to Bond, though. He doesn't know any celebrities yet. Yeah. He hasn't made those connections. Like, how much does an Aston Martin cost?
Hundreds of thousands. I don't think it's at million, but it's
They're just like
high hundreds of thousands.
They're just giving him those.
They are.
He wrecks them. Yeah. They give him a new one. Like they got some money.
This is true. I will say the counter to that is that. If they lose that money, it's financing terrorists.
That is another thing I love about this table is that they never establish who anyone is except the fact that two of them are cops. So $20 million of this month, $25
million. Oh, yeah, Felix Leiter's there.
Felix gives him $5 million.
Yeah.
So $25 million is supplied by cops to the bad guys. And I love the idea that everyone else at that table is also a cop.
Yeah.
And we just don't know it.
That would be
their all play. It's like,
everyone except Lashifa.
Oh, KGB. Yeah. And like,
I'm CSIS is there.
CSIS like all, is
I'm Scotland Yard. Yeah. RCMP over here. Yeah. Everyone's a cop.
I love that comedic version of this where none of it works if it weren't for the fact that all of the governments are buying in to try to get at this guy.
Yeah, he has gotten $150 million of the governments of the world's money, and he was the only criminal playing is my headcanon for the entire thing. Because none of them were like, oh, my friend LeChiffre, I'm also a villain. Like, none of them established they were bad guys.
Yeah, I also would like a version where one of them is a celebrity, now that I'm thinking about how this is a small enough buy-in, celebrities could be there. I don't normally encourage celebrity cameos in film, but this easily could be just fucking someone who's rich and likes gambling. Michael Jordan is just at the table, and he's just like, yeah, whatever, $5 million buy-in. And James Bond is having a heart attack trying to convince the queen to give him $5 million. And Jordan is just there going all in.
So you obviously missed the celebrity cameo that is in this movie.
Oh, who is the celebrity cameo?
So while they're running through airport security, standing there getting waved down is Richard Branson.
Oh. Yeah. I did not catch that at all.
He could definitely afford to buy it.
Branson exactly. could be there.
Yeah, but he was there for the airport scene and not the poker scene, because I guess the poker scene was like, that was apparently hell to film.
Oh.
Because all the continuity errors with all the chips and everything like that, they were like
brutal.
Yeah, they were like it was really difficult to film, and they had to like keep track of everything and like you know where they were in the game and what cards were up and everything like all that.
Right, that's fair.
All right.
Yeah, and you're like that scene. Like they did a world record for flipping that Aston Martin on its head. It more flips than any car had ever done. Yeah,
oh, cool.
In that scene, but they were like the hardest scene was the poker scenes.
Oh, shit.
Hit a guy jumping off of a construction building. And the hardest scene was the poker
filmmaking. Yeah. Continuities. So tricky. A guy jumps off a building. That's one piece of continuity.
That's one quick moment. But I agree with you about the $5 million. Canonically, in the film, Vesper... Well, it's like, you don't want to fund the criminals, but also Vesper wants James to lose. Because if James wins, he's going to get tortured for the password, as we see.
Yes.
So she doesn't want to give him $5 million more because she knows, because she's working for the bad guys.
Which we don't know. And
we don't know.
If we can talk about Vesper for a second, because by God, one, Eva Green, one of the sexiest Bond women ever. Like, I don't know what it is about this movie in particular, but I was just like, wow. And legitimately, the only James Bond girl I've ever felt that has, like, there's actually been some connection between the two of them.
Ooh, I can agree with that.
And that was, and, like, the point of the movie is that they are falling in love despite each other. And I love that that is the point of the movie. That he is then betrayed, and that's what turns him into the cold-hearted, jaded guy who was opening up, and then he's shut down, and you understand where he's coming from. But so much screen time is actually dedicated to their relationship. It's amazing.
I agree with you. It fully works. I think she crushes it. And it's one of the hardest romances to sell. Like, any on-screen romance is tough. Like, actors need to have chemistry. It's tough to sell. These two have the chemistry. I think it works. And then the toughest romance to sell in film, on camera in general, is the, like, we do not respect or like each other, but fall in love. And normally, in most films, that's so tricky, because even if the actors have chemistry, it's just these two would actually hate one another. Fuck these two. They do not want to be together at all. But they, like...
The rapport...
She really does sell it and create that rapport and make it work.
The again, to go on that train, I think that is one of the sexiest scenes ever, where it's just the two of them on the train sparring at each other, and just that end line where she goes, so I'll be keeping my money I'll keep my eyes on the money and not on your perfectly formed ass. And he goes, so you notice. She goes, even accountants have imagination. And then she goes, how is the lamb? And he goes, skewered. I can relate. And like, then they just say goodnight to each other and leave. I'm like, oh fuck, you're equals. Like, as much as they've tried making like, oh, it's a strong, powerful woman who can do the same things James Bond can. Again, going back to Die Another Day and like Halle Berry, who is like a nothing character in that, compared to Vesper, who's just like very different priorities, but is just like, I am your intellectual equal. We will have that same sparring. Yeah. That the line she has about, like, he goes to kiss her at the poker game, and she goes,
you entered through the wrong door. Oh, did I? She knows
what she did, and he kisses her, and he goes, this is part of our cover, and we're characters now. We've disposed with one thing, and we're doing another. And then he goes to kiss her again, and she turns away, and he goes, this is my character. Being mad that you've been losing for the last hour. Weirdly enough, my character's motivations follow my own. Like, I was just like, oh, like, just...
She says the lines so fast, you almost, like, don't notice how clever they are. But, like, they're... Because to me, the sticking point is when he, like, comes in with his tux, and he's like, it's tailored. She's like, I sized you up nicely.
And they had both done the same thing to each other.
Yeah, I got you this dress. Yes. Like, dresses are easier because they're a little stretchier. You don't really have to size someone up as much. But, like, yeah, a tailored outfit is much different. But Vesper has so many levels happening as well, because she is there to do her job, and she's like actually has a function. She's not just a damsel in distress. She's like, I am here because I work at the Treasury and you need $15 million. Like, she has a function. She's there falling in love with James. And then when you know she is betraying him the whole time because her boyfriend has been kidnapped off screen that we never see, there is so much more happening. You're like, they are at odds and they like spite each other and they have good banter. But then when you look at her actions, like, she does walk in the wrong door and distracts James instead of anyone else. And you're like, oh, it's because she like doesn't like him. Yeah. And you're like, oh, no, wait. When you know later, you're like, oh, it's because she wants James to lose. She actually was trying to distract him, but like in a way that he won't notice. So she's out spying him the whole movie. She has like three levels going on.
And there's a great piece of dialogue where she goes, does everybody have a towel? And he's like, everybody, except for you.
I can't
read you. And it's just like, oh, that's, it's like, it's foreshadowing, but it's just like, oh, she's the one who fucks him over.
But does she not have a tell because she's always been lying?
Right.
Like, if you bluff every single hand, there is no tell.
Right.
Yeah. So like, she's been lying since day one, like about why she's here, but like in a sad way. Yeah. Not in a way that I beat James Bond, but like, I'm trying to protect James Bond and my boyfriend. I am a woman who's trying to have it all. Yeah.
And I didn't want to fall in love with you. And I think the scene that really like grounds what she's going through really well is that stairway fight scene where she sees James Bond murder a man. Like, choke him out, like just with his arm after getting his chest slashed open with a machete, and she's like kicking the gun away and just watching. And it's like, the movie acknowledges that is an incredibly traumatizing event, both for James Bond and for her. Like, we see James Bond go, and he has to like bandage his chest up, like put on a new shirt. You see him chug a glass of whiskey or scotch with like a shaking hand, and then he goes and plays and finishes the game, but then comes back and he finds her fully clothed, weeping in the shower, shuddering, and you're like, oh, that affected you.
Yeah.
And then, she works at the Treasury.
Yeah. She's a surprisingly adept spy, as we find out by the end of the film, but she still has not witnessed a murder before. She is a good, a master level manipulator.
And also helped do it. Like, she held the guy's arm down.
Right.
Yeah.
And that I think is like her seeing James Bond as like, oh, your brutality and like the fact that you kill and you have a gun.
Yeah.
Is something I thought of you less for, but now I see why it has to happen, because these things happen in this world.
In that moment, though, I could have done without the sucking the blood off her fingers.
Yeah, that was
very, very gross and weird and out of place. It felt like it wasn't her dealing with PTSD and like, I can't get the blood off. I feel like him just washing her hands would have been yeah. oddly sexual and helpful and romantic. Sucking it off was weird. A very weird, weird
moment.
I do moment.
Like the reach back and turn up the temperature.
That's nice.
That's nice.
Like, I love how he just like gets in with his fully clothed.
There are
like
nice moments in there, for sure.
I'm with Andrew. That's such a weird thing to do for a scene that doesn't lead to a sex scene. And it is also very strange, but I'm happy about it because it gives her character so much more agency. It's like they never have sex until after the torture scene. Like,
yeah.
She's never naked. You never see it, like... There's never like a sexy Eva Green sex scene. She always just looks good with clothes on, and she looks incredible.
Yeah.
But yeah, very weird to suck someone's fingers and then be like, and then we'll cuddle.
Yeah.
It's not usually the bond sequence of events.
Exactly. It showed some restraint. It showed some difference. It differentiated it from like the string of just like...
You got to test the waters, I guess.
This is a woman I slept with now and like... But... To contrast that, the woman he does sleep with, actually, I don't think he actually does end up sleeping with her, the dude's wife.
Yeah.
And she just ends up dead, and he's like, whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, he leaves her to go to the airport.
Yep. Yeah, that's true.
Another thing I really like, very subtle in this movie, is he says he's not into Vesper because he's only into single women.
Yeah.
Or no, he's into married women.
Yeah.
And then she turns out to be married.
Yeah.
Oh, shit. Good observation there. Shit.
She was secretly married all along.
Yeah, you're not my type, smart. Single. Such a good, like, wah, bah, 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 ah.
Now, the one part of their relationship that doesn't quite pan out for me and is when they get towards the end, so after the ball torture, which is really the only way to, like, frame the end of this movie, to be like, there's pre-ball torture and post-ball torture.
It's the AD of...
yeah. But, yeah, it is. It's the ADBC. But it's when... He states that he's gotten the theme from the movie when he hasn't. And this is where the writing just becomes a little bit muddled. Like, the performance is still good. The building sinking into the water is still good. But the writing becomes a bit muddled for me because he has this scene with Vesper where she's like, you've got your armor up again, James. And he's like, I don't. You've stripped it down. And it's like, but you do. That's a line. Like, she asked you to be like, how has this affected you emotionally? Like, she wanted a sincere answer, and he's only delivering lines back. Mm. And it's lines about how he's not delivering lines, but that's still a line. Like, that is not you being emotionally vulnerable. It is still you ducking the question. Like, she is asking him about him and how he is. And he is ducking the question with an answer about how he doesn't duck questions anymore. And that is, I don't know if that's meant to be three-dimensional chess. And James, and I'm not saying it's bad writing it's as much as it is unclear to me, where I'm like, I don't know if this is supposed to show James can never fully shut it off, or if it's just a bad way of them showing that he shut it off. So I don't love that kind of towards the end of their relationship.
I will agree with this. I actually... post-ball torture in that world. I get why Vesper's with him, because she has to be, even if she feels something for him or not, she needs to get that money. I actually don't feel like James would be all in on her. Like, they didn't really go through what they went through together. They didn't, like, survive the torture together. She didn't save him. He didn't save her. It feels very abrupt to me and not quite earned enough when they're, like, just... He's like, I'm quitting... MI6 for you. Like, I don't feel like they've gotten there yet at that point.
And especially when he states the theme of the movie and betrays it, because the lesson from Mathis, so he's talking to her and he's like, Mathis betrayed us. And I'm never going to make that mistake again. I've learned from Mathis. Never trust anyone. I'll leave MI6 for you. Like, you just stated your character's arc for this movie and then gave up on the character's arc. And, like, you can be that obvious.
I'll give you the password to the money.
And it's okay for a movie to be that obvious, for a lead character to be like, well, here was the theme of the film. But you can't do that right before he learns the theme of the film.
You
have to do that a few scenes. So that's why, like, that hospital, the post-ball torture, the PBT era, it just becomes a little muddled to be like, does he know the theme of the film or not? And does he have armor on or not? And I don't fully buy it.
So I'm going to counterpoint this, which is the full quote is, you're not going to let me in. You've got your armor back on. And he goes, I've got no armor left. You stripped it from me. Whatever is left of me, whatever I am, is yours. That line means that when she betrays him, he's nothing.
Okay.
We have, and we have finally arrived at the cold, calculated, despondent, egoless James Bond at the end of this, because he goes, I'm fully exposed. I'm bearing my soul to you. I'm ready to love. And then that betrayal is like the last of it. Like he's irredeemable at this point. And that's what I feel like that's more about, is just like my ability to open up is here, which I never thought I would have because I'm a cold killer. And everything that happens after that with the betrayal and her drowning herself and like all the rest is just like this puts it in there. And that last line, which is iconic, it's in the book or whatever, the bitch is dead. And you just go, this man has started, like he's down a path now that he's never coming back from.
I can get on that because yeah, if he's got no armor, her betrayal goes straight to his heart and it does kill him. And like, you can even see it in that final fight scene. He's no longer panicked. He's no longer out of breath when he fights. Like that whole last fight scene in the sinking building, he's just a cold, calculated killing machine.
Yeah.
It's a totally different man.
Yeah, that's a murderer.
Yeah, like he does a great job of being like, I'm a different person now during this fight.
All right, well, I think that's everything that I wanted to say on Casino Royale. We all feeling good?
I'm feeling good, yeah. That's the casino.
Let's
yeah.
go in it's for the Royale. Close. Let's ask the final question of what would you change? So now that we've discussed everything we discussed, what would you change about this movie if you could change anything? But before we do ask that final question, we want to remind you, as we do every week, is take a moment and subscribe, rate, review, hit follow, whatever podcatcher you use, whether it's Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podcast Addict, whatever you might be using. Hit that follow or subscribe button, leave a rating and review. It's very important to us because it helps guarantee that you are going to get the new episodes show up in your feed and kind of remind you every week. Even if you love us, sometimes it's nice to have a gentle reminder to be like, hey, that thing you love, it came out this morning, here it is, check out the thing. And when you rate and review, it helps us move up the charts. It helps encourage new people to hit download. And it's really important, not just to us, but any podcast out there. So take a couple minutes and rate and review us and a few of your other favorite podcasts, because it actually does make a big difference to people who create this.
You could review us. You could review The Villain Was Right, starring Craig Faye. You could leave a couple of reviews. It really does mean a lot, and it only takes a second, and it does so much for us if you've got a few seconds, a few minutes, whatever you need.
Absolutely. Free way to support the podcast. And if you do want to support the podcast monetarily, you can check us out over on Patreon. Patreon's a monthly subscription service where you can get exclusive access to bonus content from our network. So over at Patreon, you can kick in $1 a month, $5, $10, $100, $1 million, $5 million, the most amount of money that the Treasury Department can imagine. you can kick in whatever is in your budget, whatever Vesper approves you to kick in. But at the $10 hero level, you get a bonus episode of this podcast every single month that's exclusive to our Patreon.
And you get access to all the old episodes. And also, if you head on over right now, if you like Bond content, we did Quantum of Solace this month. It is available right now. You can head on over. So you've gotten Casino Royale. Now you got Quantum of Solace. It's all the Bonds you can handle on Patreon.com.
Head on over. Check it out at Patreon.com/FromSuperheroes. That's PATREON.com/FromSuperheroes. And now let's go in for the close. Let's ask the final question of what would you change about this movie if you could change anything. Diana, let's start with you. What would you change?
My change is Mads Mikkelsen needs to have a plot we're trying to stop. I don't really like we're doing all of this so he'll be poor is the end goal. I'm like, it's
poor so we can turn him.
Yeah, it's not super exciting. I would like it more if it was you are infiltrating and he does not know you're a spy and you're trying to figure out what his next, like, I'm blowing up an airport thing is. Like, he is investing in something else. You need to figure out what it is. You need to stop it. You do stop it. Now he does really need that $150 million. So I would like more of more stakes. For a poker game, the stakes are low, I would say. That we just need him to be poor and we're giving him money if he does lose. So yeah, he has some kind of airport-like plan for a second time. We stop that. Then he needs all your money because you've stopped a second plan of his. Now he's real poor. It's not much of a change because it's a very, very good movie. So that's it for me.
I like that. All right, so Craig, what would you change?
Yeah, so I very much love this movie, so very little. it's very hard for me to pick. What I would say is upon rewatch, this is a very long movie. It is like 2.5 hours long. I think you could edit it down to be a little tighter. Specifically kind of within some of the casino scenes, I do feel like maybe those tend to drag on. Watching people gamble and play poker isn't exactly the most engaging thing. I still think they do a very good job of making it compelling. But yeah, I think that's what I would change. Just like maybe a little tighter. If you could like bring that down to 2 hours, I think this movie would fly.
I would love that. I do feel it's like a little bit long sometimes. I would actually maybe cut down like an action scene or two. Like I think the chase scene and the parkour scene are both pretty long, even though they're really good. But, like, if you only showed, like, the super good parts, that's a great change.
I like that.
Andrew, what would you change?
I agree that it does need to be shorter and tighter. For me, everything PBT, post-ball torture, is cuttable. Cut it. I think that...
Oh, that's the whole movie.
I understand. But at that point, the movie has gone on so long. And I agree with you, Craig, that, like, the casino stuff is kind of, like, quiet, not necessarily engaging. But that feels like it's the tone of the movie and
it
what they want
casino
to do.
Royale, yeah.
Exactly.
Get that casino out of here, says Craig Faye.
And I say is that, like, you can keep the Vesper betrayal stuff, but I feel like that should all happen in the, like, derelict boat that that Lashif has the torture scene in. Like, that all needs to play out on that set.
Ooh.
And because when they go to the hospital and re-lull the audience into a false sense of confidence, now we're going into a weird four-act structure, which actually structurally doesn't make sense. And that false sense of like, well, James is going to have the ending that every James Bond movie has where he rides a boat into the sunset with his love and they have sex on a boat is implied. And when you lull the audience into that false sense of security, it works. But then I'm like, well, the movie's over. Everyone emotionally is like, the movie is over. All the goodwill has dried up. All of our action has, like, the adrenaline has worn off as an audience. I'm ready to stop watching a movie. And that's what they're going for, to be like, you think it's over, but it's not. I'm like, yes, but I still feel like I don't want to watch movie anymore.
We're at the 2-hour and 10-minute mark.
I leave now. Movie done. Finish it. So I think the Vesper betrayal needs to happen like in conjunction with the torture scene and in that derelict boat and everything like that. And you can have the like derelict boat sinking that they're being tortured on as opposed to this like this other thing. Like that is a boat, right? Or I think it's
like an old building. Yeah.
Oh, it's an old building? I thought it was like a stripped down old cargo boat
they
for some
like
reason.
They felt like bulkheads, the
doors.
Oh,
in the torture. Yeah, I think that's a boat. That's a boat. Yeah, sorry.
So like just get that ending in that room. And do it there. And I want it to be snappier and end quicker.
Still a much better ending than the book, where they just kind of spend a couple days in a hotel and then she drowns herself in the bathtub. And it takes 2 or 3 chapters.
Whoa! All right, well, maybe the movie... In that regard, I enjoy the what would you change that the movie already did. So that's pretty good. Better than bathtub drowning. I'll give it that.
I love this change because we said, like, he's like, at the hospital, he says, I'm stripped of all armor. But if he found out she betrayed him while he was literally naked and being tortured, like, the destruction of James Bond's psyche in that moment would be absolute.
Yeah.
Like, that would be so terrible, maybe you couldn't even do that to a man, to betray him while he's being naked and tortured.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, I think we fixed it.
We fixed it.
It was very good.
It was like, just had like one little crack in it. It was pretty good.
$5 million isn't enough money as well. It's not enough
so
money.
Obsessed
it's not,
with
I'm so, it's not that much money.
I guess even in like... Austin,
like, I don't have it, but people do have that.
Even in Austin Powers, they're like, $1 million isn't a lot to ask for, yeah, Dr. Evil.
Yeah. And this
and
many years later
is
like,
only five?
Question mark? It's not enough
Fair
money.
Fair enough.
All right. Well, that's going to be it for this week. We are going to be back with Spectre next week is what we're going to be talking about before is a continuation of our buildup for No Time to Die. But in the meantime, Craig, where can the people find you, listen to you?
Yeah, so you can follow me on Twitter at Craig Faye Comedy or on Facebook, Craig Faye Comedy, craigfaye.com for show dates. And as well, I don't know if you know this, I've got a podcast on this network, The Villain Was Right, which you can check us out there. We discuss movies and TV where the villain was arguable. So we do that. So check it out wherever you get podcasts, The Villain Was Right.
It's a wonderful show.
Love it. And if you want to get a hold of us, you can follow me on Twitter at Ivamey, I-V-I-M-E-Y.
You can reach me at Words of Diana.
And you can reach both of us at From Superheroes. And we'll see y'all next week for Spectre. Take care.
Bye.